Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 548, a best of episode. This was originally played in 2011. This was one of the first 20 episodes that we ever recorded. And for those of you that have listened to the podcast many times, that voice that says everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful, fucked up in some weird way, that's from this interview with Greg. And it's one of my favorite episodes. So enjoy it. I will be back in August with all new episodes. Our sponsor this week, as always, is BetterHelp.com online therapy. If you're interested in checking it out, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the /mental part so they know you came from this podcast. Then fill out a questionnaire, and if they have a counselor they feel is a good fit for you, they will match you up with one, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's your thing. You need to be over 18, and BetterHelp is licensed in all 50 states. Without any further ado, here is that episode.
Everybody, yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
Couple of quick notes before we get to the Greg Barrett interview. Keep your emails coming. I love getting feedback from you guys. Visit the website, mentalpod.com, and there's a survey, a mental illness survey that I kind of came up with that helps me get to know who you are, and you can see the results that everybody else, their answers, so you can kind of browse through there, and it's a fascinating way to realize that so many of us think we're terminally unique, but we're really not. And it helps me feel less alone, and I kind of enjoy doing that, especially when I find somebody that's more fucked up than me. I'll be honest. It feels pretty good. I feel victorious. There's a form on the website. Check that out. You can join it and exchange information with people. You can sign up for my mental illness happy hour group at Facebook. My Twitter name is MentalPod. I think it's pretty obvious that there are just too many ways to contact each other at this point. I'm really close to just heading into the mountains and shelving this whole fucking thing. But maybe I'll hang on for one more week. If you want to support the show financially, that would always be greatly appreciated. You can support it non-financially by giving us good ratings at iTunes. That helps us boost our visibility, and that's always good for my ego. And I think that is about... Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention, I haven't had any non-white guests on the show yet. It doesn't mean I'm not trying. I'm reaching out, and I'm not Hitler, but I do enjoy a nice parade. So, and one last thing was, I have a lot of sober guests on the program. I'm not trying to push any type of non-drug or alcohol agenda. It just happens that most of the people I know that are willing to talk about their feelings and their pain and their fears and all that stuff happen to be people that that have gotten sober. So I am not anti-drug or anti-alcohol. Just anti that for me. In fact, I'm a little jealous that medical marijuana came around after I got sober. So if you're enjoying that, fuck you. I'm here with.
There won't be any calls coming in. That's those that phone is for show business. So we will not be interrupted at any point.
I'm here with Craig Barron. I just asked him to turn his phone off, and Craig doesn't believe that's going to be a problem.
It's not going to be a problem. I've actually turned my career off, so that phone will not be ringing at all. My wife is out of town. I don't expect to hear from her either, and my kids are locked up until 3. So we are good to go.
We're good to go. Your dogs have no interest in you.
No, they're not interested either.
Yeah.
I have no food for them. So, yeah.
I'm at Greg Barron's house in Southern California, and you know Greg from a variety of things. Is did a half hour HBO special a while back that I loved. You wrote a book called "He's Just Not That Into You," which then became a movie. You have a band that you perform with that's great. I listened to your CD and loved it. It's called The Reigning Monarchs. And you have a podcast called Walk in the Room that you do with Dave Anthony that is really gaining some traction.
Yeah. In the house here.
In the house here.
I have downloaded. Yeah. I downloaded like 2 or 3 times.
Yeah. The nearby neighborhood is kind of cool to it, but a lot of fans in the house. A lot of fans in the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sent me an email a couple of weeks ago and said that you'd listen to the podcast, and if I ever needed a guest, you'd be happy to come on. And I was so flattered because I've always admired your comedy. That it's you walk that line that to me is so difficult to do in stand-up, which is to keep the laughs coming, but have a core of emotional honesty and vulnerability. And I think it's lacking in a lot of comedy. I think podcasts are exploding now because it's a perfect medium for it. But there was always a hint of it in your comedy. And was that because you started out in the San Francisco scene? Was it more conducive to that, or is that just kind of who you always were?
You know what? I actually think it's who I became. When I started, I was trying...
By the way, is that your gas or your dog's? Because somebody is shitting themselves.
That is not my brand.
Yeah, because it smells like dog gas.
Yeah, no, mine's Woodsier.
Yeah. That is just
that dog
rank.
Left, by the way. That dog farted and then went, you know what, man? I can't take this. And just left. I can't even sit in my own stink for this.
Yeah.
I sort of came to that. I did like... most of us do, which is you have a personality that you exhibit in life, and then you think you should do comedy with it, and then you spend a lot of time trying to get that person on stage. But at the beginning, you're David Cross, you're Jake Johansson, you're any 10 people that you're around that you love. And mm-hmm. You know, it was funny because I really liked joke writers, and I really liked the surrealist. I really liked like what Dana Gould was doing, and Bob Rubin and Jeff Bolt. These are guys that were in San Francisco that were just so obscure. And I really liked that. And that's not, while I like that, that's not who I am.
Right.
And I tried to be weird. I tried to be strange. I tried to be all of those things that in San Francisco people were encouraged to be.
Right.
And then I got sober and went, well, now you're just fucking stuck with you. So now what?
Right.
And that's when, how
long ago did you get sober?
So I'm 14 and two-thirds there to 15. You know what I mean? I'm
almost 15 years?
Almost 15
or
years.
Minutes.
15,
15 years, years or minutes? Because that's a big difference.
15 minutes. I've been for this. I'm going to be, we're coming on 16 minutes of pure sobriety. And when I say pure, I mean only part of the way because I'm on a handful of awesome pills that I took. Or did I? I don't remember. No, I have, God willing, I will be 15 in August.
That's fantastic.
So when I got sober, I started to think more like myself, and mm-hmm. I started to, in this crowd of hipsters that I was around, these incredible people, I was the guy that liked Poison sincerely, the band. And I started saying that on stage in these rooms that I was in, and sort of saying, hey, I know we're all hip here, but I like Poison, not as a joke. And that made people laugh. And I was like, oh, if I just tell the truth about who I am, maybe. And my mom, interestingly enough, when I first started doing stand-up, she was like, I don't understand what you're doing. Why don't you just be like you are at dinner?
Right.
And I'm like, because you don't fucking...
Hungry? How are people going to laugh at hunger?
Rude?
Africa's not funny.
Eating with my fingers? I don't get it. But I mean, she really did was like, you are just naturally a good storyteller. Why don't you do that? And I was like, because you don't understand the business. People like jokes and, you know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. So that was my thing, was to try and figure out how to create that on stage, you know.
And about how far into doing stand-up did you feel like... until you finally found your voice?
I still am finding it. You know, that's the kind of cool journey about it, as I evolve as a person. And, you know, you find it. I think what's interesting is, I think it exists in the bits, and then they become not you. Mm-hmm. You mold an idea for me. Because I write kind of on stage. So I'll have an idea and I'll go up and it'll be part of the way there. And then I will find it and then it'll be there. And then as soon as those words get locked in, that bit is over. And then I'm insincere. So it's a combination of like living it, trying to live it a little bit and trying to figure out how it exists on stage with sincerity and freshness.
Yeah.
You know? And it's hard because it isn't like this, which you mentioned, which is, this is absolutely completely happening right now, genuinely sincere and in the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the interesting thing about this podcasting stuff, is that suddenly people can listen to their favorite comics, and if they're good at broadcasting, go, oh shit, I almost like this better because it's happening now and it's genuine.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's a depth to it that, you know, we were talking before we started rolling, that the stuff that I'm able to talk about on podcasts is stuff I've always wanted to talk about on stage, but I could never find a way to do it because there's that pressure of punchline, punchline, punchline. You know, you're following a feature act who's crushing,
right?
You know, you're the headliner. You've got to top him. The checks are going out. People are distracted. I mean, headlining is a motherfucker. It is hard work being a headlining road comic and trying to get what is in your soul out on stage and to survive financially at the same. Because you can go up there and be true to yourself, but chances are most of the crowd may not like it because they come into the comedy club with a preconceived notion of what stand-up is going to be.
Right. They're not actually interested in your needs. They're interested in their needs, and their needs are that they want to be entertained on in a way, especially if they're coming in uneducated about you. If they know something of you, they come in and they're like, okay, I think I'm getting the Greg Barrett brand here, so I suspect I'll hear a little bit about candy, and I'm going to hear a little bit about football, or I'm going to hear a little bit about, you know, whatever it is that they know you for. But if they come in uneducated, they just want to laugh, and they want to laugh pretty soon, and they also want a chicken wing, and they'd like to have that now, and where the fuck is my beer?
Yeah.
You know, so then you're kind of dealing with all of these other expectations. And the interesting thing about it is, as an art form, it was genuinely meant to be just performed almost in a theater, you know, but you can't get to the theater. You know, the comedy clubs sort of exist. And while I do like the way comedy clubs are set up, I actually like the intimacy of a comedy club. To really get people's attention, you need to take shit out of their hands, right? And let them sit there. And that is not how it's set up. So you're
set up basically in the traditional stand-up comedy club of today. You are really an appetizer. You're the big appetizer at the club.
That's the weird thing about it, which is like you are not the main consideration. I mean, in some of the clubs, to be fair, there are some very well-run clubs in this country where the managers and the wait staff work very hard to make it your show while still running a restaurant, which is what you are in.
Right.
But in a lot of places, you are just like, just dude, do your time, be quiet. I'm sorry about that guy, but they had 15 tickets, so they're not being kicked out. You'll just have to deal with that guy yelling at you.
I remember a club owner telling me one time, oh yeah, we're having this other guy back because he sells more shots than anybody else. And I remember just thinking, I'm fucked.
Yeah,
I'm fucked. You know, if this is the criteria that being a popular club comic is based on, you know, what I didn't realize is that there are better clubs than that one. And there's a lot of clubs out there that book people based on the originality of their comedy. But, you know, you got to remember, like a guy like Bill Hicks, who is beloved nowadays and idolized posthumously, he walked rooms full of people. He was despised by the, and that's him calling from the grave.
Yeah,
you guys, I was not despised.
That's not at all how it was, guys, and I will kick you right in the teeth. I'm going to just let that happen. Comedian, I don't understand what this thing is he's doing. And he's a gay Southern comedian, and he's going on and on and on. And this isn't who I expected to be here. Mm-hmm. And then he would just snap into another. And he didn't mind just fucking jerking people in one direction. And I was like, that takes balls.
It does. It does.
I think I'm losing you in a conversation, and I start fucking weaving. I am like, well, let's see if this works. You know, that is the other thing I like about doing the podcast with me and my buddy Dave. Dave we make each other laugh, and that's enough.
Yeah.
But it's so nice to just have that one concern and not worry about what a lot of the people do. And I think that's made me a better artist, because suddenly I realize, you know, I don't have to get everybody.
Yeah.
There are people that I want to get. There are people that I think are on my team and I want to get them. But I'm okay. It took me a while to get there post-book, but I'm okay with losing you. It's okay.
Yeah.
Girl last night, I end with a thing where I talk about Tim Tams, which are that Australian cookie that's now here in the States. And they're amazing. And I compare them to God's vagina. And clearly I rocked a woman's boat last night. Yeah. She walked out and was like, I liked that until the end. And then I hated it.
Oh, really?
And I was okay to let her go. She's got to go, because that's my philosophy. That's my God, which is a Tim Tam. I'm going to go ahead and have that feeling about it and let her go, because we were never going to, you have to realize too, sometimes like those people aren't going to, for lack of a better description, buy your t-shirt.
Yeah.
They're not real fans. You just want, especially in these days where everyone gets only a little bit of the pie. You just want those hardcores. They'll keep you in business forever.
Yeah, that's what Lenny Bruce used to say, is give me 2,000 fans in every city and I'm set for life.
Set for life.
Yeah.
That's all you need. And because they love you, and I heard Paul Tompkins talk about this, it's not that he is opposed to the idea of winning over people that he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
How far can he go with people that he does know, that do know him?
Yeah.
What are the risks he's going to take?
Mm-hmm.
Where is he going to go as an artist if the room's already set up to win?
Right.
Right. Some people like the challenge. Some people are like, well, then you're not a real comic if you can't go into a room. I'm like, no, it's all different. Maybe that's you.
Different.
But I love that idea of like, now I'm in a room where I have the love.
Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with
further?
That? Yeah. I like that. Let's talk about your childhood growing up.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of childhood?
I had an interesting childhood in that I grew up, my parents were wealthy. My dad was in television. He was he was the general manager of the NBC affiliate in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom had some family money and also worked at the TV station until she had me. And she was a Stanford grad. They're both bright people. And so they were lovely. But my mom was an alcoholic, but high functioning. I had bad eyes when I was born. I had very, very cross eyed. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of surgeries when I was little. So I was in and out of hospitals a lot. I'd do a thing where I would get these surgeries and I couldn't touch my eyes. So they had to tape my hands to my side and I had to eat off a plate and I had eye patches a lot. So I had a very strange childhood, but I was very loved.
Yeah.
You know, loved by two parents that grew up in that. This is Mad Men times. I mean, my parents were kind of that world. I remember watching the first episode of that and my dad with my father. My mother's passed away, but my father's still alive, very much alive. And he went, that's a little real for me. That's a little real for me. The drinking and the smoking and the thing. And just like that was the time. Like,
what do you back up? I didn't quite understand that. That what's a little real for you?
Watching Mad Men.
Yeah,
the first episode, and saying that's a little real for me. Like it was a little tough for him to revisit how we used to be.
Yeah,
the drinking, the smoking, the like. You know, I mean, the Mad Men's not.
Dad was except for the philandering. Although he might have philandered, as far as I know, but my dad was Don Draper. I have pictures of going to visit him in the early 70s in his office, and it is just like Don Draper's office. He had a bar in his office.
Yes.
You know, he was an insurance executive, and he would come home and, you know, he would have a couple of drinks. He was always smoking a cigarette. And it was a big deal that he had been promoted. He worked for CNA Insurance, and it was a big deal when he was made vice president because he was Catholic.
Yes. Right? So there's the thing about the Mad Men that is so interesting is that it is sort of no apologies. This is what it was like. We're not glorifying it. We're also not putting it down.
Yes.
You know, I think it fairly paints people of that generation pre These are pre-AA times.
Yes, and you got to remember, these people were raised by, you know, people that from the Depression.
Yes, that's right.
So they also were had a different set of parents.
Right, and so the morals were different, and time. So the times were different. So that was sort of the world I grew up in. But my parents were festive people who liked to have parties,
Would your mom at the parties ever get drunk to the point that it was embarrassing to you?
Forever.
Talk about that.
So just be that kind of thing where you and my sister and I sort of knew after 6 o'clock, it's a different lady. Yeah. Literally, like, boom. And yeah. And moments where you...
What time would she start drinking? At 6?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it was very, like,
but
boom.
Because she waited till 6, she couldn't possibly be an alcoholic.
Not at all. Right. Couldn't be an alcoholic. Yeah. And so she just... but there was always behavior that was baffling. And of course, you're wee, so you don't understand any of it. And yeah. It was always.
Can you describe what some of the behavior was?
It'd be that weird thing of, like, my sister and always, what I would always trip when we heard her feet hit heavy on the floor. Mm-hmm. Because you knew she was going to come in and have some weird conversation with you that didn't make sense. Or yeah. She'd be upset about something that hadn't happened.
Yeah.
Or she'd be angry. Mostly it was at herself. Like, she had to just went to a place of bizarre self-loathing. And have conversations
about... So she'd
about
get kind of dark.
Dark. But inwardly, like, she never... She would be upset with you, but you wouldn't know why. But she wasn't like... She wouldn't hit or anything like that. She was just sad.
The feeling that the world wasn't right.
Yeah.
Would kind of come spilling out.
Well, I guess everyone's upset with me. I guess they're upset with me. And you'd be like, I don't know where the conversation is. So
I'm just trying to eat without hands.
Right. I'm taped. You got to untape me. But it was interesting because...
Do you remember what you felt like having your hands taped, eating?
Barely. Bobbing? Barely. I remember
you were,
being
what,
sort
four,
of,
five, three?
I think that started at three, four, and then went to like about six, okay. Somewhere in there.
And hopefully they had you do it out on the porch where the neighbor could see.
Yeah,
could
I mean, I kind of like... Look, there's a part of it that I think built my show business career because I think my parents were funny about it.
Yeah.
And my parents are both sharp and super funny. And so, eating, it was novel. I was sort of a little celebrity in the house. I had to eat with my hands tied to my side and I had to eat off a table. You know, they put the plate on the stool and then I had to eat off the stool. I mean, it was only for a short period of time, but there was that, like, oh, this is special time.
Right.
You know, I also knew, and I shared this before.
So it wasn't necessarily a painful memory. It was, you got attention and you kind of liked
that?
Yeah,
but it was weird in that also going in and out of hospitals as a young boy, I'd come upstairs and I would see the little plaid suitcase and know I was going to the hospital. And that fear of, like, oh God, I'm going in for another surgery. So there were all those surgeries. So that was sort of it as a little boy, you know, then my sister was born and then my father, my father was about to be promoted and he didn't like the people he worked for and he quit.
Yeah.
Said, forget it. And we moved to Marin County, which was not as developed as it is now. But we bought a home and he had nothing. He wasn't doing anything. He was like, and he bought a radio station up in Oregon and he bought another one. He bought two radio stations and he ran those. And that's what he did. He was a broadcaster and he ran radio stations, but he lived in Marin. And so now he was an entrepreneur. Now he wasn't that world. It was a different world. And he had his office downstairs in the house. So he was around and that's when I was like 10 and from 10 to 18, I lived in Marin with my parents there and had a really white suburban upbringing, really walked to school every day. And
let's back up a little bit to the surgeries as a child, because I had a lot of surgeries as a child, and I think in a lot of ways it kind of informed who I became later in life. I had a thing that a lot of little boys do where their testicles don't descend,
right.
And so you have to go in, you got to get a surgery for that. And I was so ashamed about my body. I felt like, like I'm a freak. I was so terrified that anybody else was going to know, and for years, I mean, even through my teenage years, even though I had the surgery to fix it, it wasn't perfect. And so I would be like, just ashamed of my genitalia. You know what I mean?
Right.
My dick's not big enough. My testicles aren't perfectly even. And I remember thinking, before I ever, got laid, that, am I going to be rejected for this?
You know,
why, if there's a God, why are you putting me, why are you putting me through this? I mean,
right.
What do you remember feeling about your...
I don't recall being sad much as a kid. Mm-hmm. I do remember thinking that there was something wrong with me, that I wasn't bright enough. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a lot of trouble because of my eyes. It made it so it was difficult for me to read and to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I was slower than everybody, and I was aware of it really quickly. And I felt from the very beginning, like, I am not as smart as everybody else.
Right.
This thing makes me less.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely felt like, fuck, I am. And so I stopped trying early. I mean, I really did. I was like, I can't. I don't really like work. I don't like reading and writing is too hard. You know?
Right.
Because, you know, my friends could all do it better. I was keenly aware of what everybody else was doing as a young boy, mm-hmm. keenly aware that other people didn't have eye surgeries and didn't, you know, whatever. And keenly aware that, like, he already finished his. All right. How could he just finish his? I'm still on the first page. Like, I was really on other people's pages. And I had a very difficult time focusing on my own shit.
Right.
You know? So I think if it did anything, it made me feel less than as...
Felt a little broken, maybe?
A little bit, yes. Yeah. A little broken. A little bit like, no, not going to be as good as everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And because of it, it made it difficult. It took me longer to learn things. I could learn them and I could adapt. My eyes would adapt, but it like took me longer to hit a baseball. It took mm-hmm. me longer to catch a baseball. I was always afraid things were going to hit me in the head because I didn't know where they were. So that gives you that
depth perception
fear. Depth perception, not barely any. Like, I focused out of one eye at a time. So mm-hmm. I could only track with one eye, and then you switch to the other eye. Like, if a ball is crossing your plane, it changes. It's up and then it's down. Right. So,
oh, wow.
So it takes a while to kind of instinctively know where that's supposed to go.
Right.
So it just was very difficult for me to.
Well, how did other kids treat you? Was there an acceptance, or did you have to really try hard to win approval from other kids?
I think that I was always pretty well liked.
Yeah.
I was always fairly social and pretty nice. I wasn't like a super shy kid. But when it came to sports, which when I was a kid, there weren't other alternatives. You're either good at sports or you were a pussy.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what it was. Yeah. Or you just were not as good as the other kids.
Like, right.
We revere other things now in children. There are many different places you can go. I mean, when I was in high school, if you had a guitar, you were a burner. You're like, you were not. Yeah. The guys that had guitars listened to Nugent, and they fucking drove muscle cars. And I loved them. I wanted to be them, but I couldn't because I grew up a very preppy, yuppie kid.
Yeah.
And so I didn't quite... You know, like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, so it took me a long time to transition into, I became a burnout, but it took me a long time to get there, you know?
Talk about that, because I also did the same thing. I stopped growing. It took me longer to hit puberty than it did everybody else. So when I was 16 years old, I was still 4'10" and weighed 85 pounds and had glasses.
Yeah.
Hello, ladies.
Oh my. right.
So, I wasn't able to compete in sports the way I was when in, you know, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade when I was decent at baseball. All of a sudden, I couldn't make the baseball team. Football's out of the question. You know, I could play a little bit of hockey, but it was, I remember making the conscious decision that I'm going to be a burnout. Because if I have a bag of weed, I will have friends.
Right. Well, I also just thought there was something about me that always was attracted to from the very, very, very beginning. This is the other thing I remember. I didn't give a shit, kind of. Like, I wanted to play sports because I wanted to be accepted by my peers, but I only want to be accepted by my peers because I thought that would be how I would get girls.
Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning, from the moment that I was conscious, I liked women and I wanted to be where women were and I wanted to get with women. I've always been very romantic. I've always been very sexual. I was like, I want to be where the girls are. I don't understand this dude shit. I will do this until we get girls. This is all fine. You wrestle.
Right.
Where are the women? Where are they? How do we get near them? I mean, I don't want to throw rocks at them. Why are we throwing rocks at them? Let's go talk to them. Like, I just... And I was, as a very... I remember coming through. I have this very vivid memory of my dad and I. It was at Christmas time. And maybe it's codified into something more grand than it was. But I remember us being walking through the at a Macy's at Christmas time, and we were in the makeup department, and we were around all these women. And my dad looked around and he turned to me and he goes, "This is where you want to be, man. You always want to be around this. You always want to be here." And I understood what he was saying. Women is where it's at, man.
Yeah,
wasn't saying go fuck chicks.
Right.
He was saying women are like, that's the thing, man. That's what you do. You're around women, right? Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was married to my mom. I mean, that was that. But he had a real appreciation and respect for women because he'd grown up single, you know, with his dad had died when he was young. So he grew up with just his mom. And they had been very poor, and he worked and earned everything that mm-hmm. he got. So I got that from him, and he was right. So that was that thing of like Star Wars came around. I watched the first Star Wars movie, and the second one came out. I was like, where are the girls? Like, I don't.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
did you have any sisters?
Yes, I have a younger sister.
Oh, okay. Because I wonder about that. I didn't have any sisters. I have one brother and a cousin that grew up with us. But there was a family across the street that had three girls, and they were all gorgeous and nice and sweet. And I would remember just the feeling when I would go visit. Mm. It was just like this warmth would come over me. Like there was something so missing from my life. And I remember sometimes we would go to their cottage for the day. They had a little cottage on the lake, and we would ride in the van. And I just remember I could live in this van with these girls the rest of my life. And I remember the Carpenters song coming on, and it was not the Rainy Days and Mondays, but what's the other the big song in there? La 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 la.
I can't remember.
Love, look at the two of us. You know.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, I remember that song came on, and I remember just to my core feeling this loneliness at the same time as feeling this happiness, and it just being so bizarre to feel such sadness and such
visceral
elation at the same time.
No, that is the I mean, that's the shit that people write about. That's the stuff that, like, I had all of my, I had a lot of cousins, and my mom's sister had four daughters. And they're all older than me, and they were all gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Heather, Cameron, and Kimberly, and Hillary. And, you know, we'd go on these vacations. I mean, they were family, whatever, but they were, you know, I was a little boy, and I was just like, wherever they were. I remember walking into a bedroom and seeing a pair of their, one of the girls' underwear was on the floor. I was like, what is that? Yeah. Like, just the mystery.
Your scalp would just tingle.
Just the mystery of what women were all about, and their things, and their smells, and their, you know, just, and they're giggling, and like, I was like, this is all that I need. Like, I've always had friends. I have three or four best friends that I've had since grammar school. We're all still friends. We all went to high school together, and then for college for a little while, blah, blah, blah. But we all love each other. Great guys. But I always was like, where are the girls? And as soon as my buddies, we were all at the same college. As soon as my buddies left and went to Arizona, I stayed at University of Oregon. I was just where the girls were. Oh, it's got in the theater department, girls. Theater department. I mean, I'm like, fuck, I'm one of three straight guys in this whole goddamn department.
Me too. It was like falling into just a pillow factory. It was like, this is the greatest.
You're like, fucking don't tell anybody about this. Do you want to know where the girls? No, don't fucking tell anyone. I'm the only, you know, and that was sort of my thing the whole time. I mean, I think it was no.
Let's talk about you becoming a theater major. Was that how was that greeted by the folks?
So I go to University of Oregon, and I
is that Eugene?
Yeah. So here's what happens. So at high school, I'm a terrible athlete.
Tell the story, by the way,
about the
only compliment you've ever got regarding sports.
Four years of high school football, I was a senior. It was halftime of a game that we're losing, and I'm the second string fullback. Now, I'd just been made fullback that year. I'd been a quarterback all the way along, and so now I'm the second string fullback because I got big, and we're losing a game, and the guy that's playing fullback first string is having a shitty game, and the coach gets us in the locker room. This is the only compliment I got in 4 years of high school football. He goes, "We got a guy out here, number 44, Ken Flax," who was a great athlete and would go on to throw the hammer in the Olympics.
Right.
"We got a guy, Ken Flax. He's out here. He's running like a goddamn pussy. And we got guys like Greg Barron here, work hard all week. We'll never see the field."
I love it. And you were happy because your name got mentioned,
I didn't get it. I mean, that is me. That story is my life. Like, I was like, yes, what? Like, in one moment, right? Now, the story that I don't always tell, that's the addendum to that, is so now, senior year football, none of the sports at our school were very good except for baseball. I started a rugby club, and the rugby club was made up of all the athletes that were shitty at all the rest of the sports. So the failed baseball players, like that, the failed football players, we all joined this rugby club for fun. What the hell? Well, we went on to win the national championships in rugby. and I was the starting hooker, which is the position in the center of the scrum, the guy that hooks the ball back. So I had this sort of little, you know, senior year comeback as an athlete on the starting hooker on the national high school national champions.
Wow.
Which was very, very cool. And
I didn't even know rugby was big out west. I would have thought the national championship would be some East Coast team.
We came back and we beat Virginia. We came back and beat Langley. We beat a school from Virginia. And but we won the West Coast division, and then we flew back and was at Dayton, Ohio, and then it was at the Army base there, and we played and we won the championship. And
the
it was
six people there went crazy.
It was weird, but there was like, you know, this, no, because what had happened was all the California teams were winning. Cal won and the San Francisco's team won. So all the schools, everybody came to watch. It was literally a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. These losers get together and their burnout coach, who lived in a van and smoked pot, truly coached us differently.
I think we got your next screenplay, buddy.
The football coach was from the old fucking Lombardi school of yelling, sure. And this guy was like, it's about finesse, bro. Right? Yeah. The guy who doesn't have the ball doesn't have the ball. Do you know what I'm talking about? No, you're high as a kite, but I'll do it. And, you know, and then
go to the open space. It's what you do without the ball.
Right, and so we're the club. It's a club. It's not a part of the school necessarily, but it's from the school, so we're sort of like, you know, I don't know. It was just a great thing to have happen, and I met a girl when I was in Ohio, and there was a car wreck, and it was a whole thing. It was a total Disney movie.
And you were how old at this point?
So what are you, senior, 17 years old, 18 years old?
Yeah.
So then I get accepted to the University of Oregon early because we know the governor, and I go there, and I decide I'm going to play rugby and be a business major. I was a little bit of a Republican at that time, just a young conservative kid. I had no political point of view, but I think I sort of straddled that conservative, joined a fraternity because that's what my dad had done, and I, you know, was a nice kid.
And again, it's where the girls were. I think that's why most guys joined
were there,
a fraternity.
And yeah, that seemed like the thing to do. And my bros were buddies; they're going to do it, and so we did that. And I immediately went, this is not a fit for me. None of this. And I broke my hand playing rugby, and it wasn't the same as being in the high school team anymore. And I was struggling with the business part of school. I really couldn't get it. And my buddy and I were sitting in at the frat house, and we were getting high, and we were picking out classes. And he's like, dude, you should just do theater, man. Just fucking get high, go down there and be a tree. How hard is that, right, bro? Get that credit. And I was like, yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So, I took a theater class and I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
And I called my parents and I was like, I'm going to be a theater major. My dad was like, Jesus, finally. Because they were like, my mom was always like, why don't you perform? You're so funny. And I'd be like, I am not funny. I'm a fucking athlete. All right. You don't fucking know me. I'm a jock. Now, the same thing I have in my senior year was I also had this other experience that was coming along at the same time. When I was a senior, I worked at my dad's radio station, and music was just a thing that we all liked and did, and I loved music, but I hadn't never had a, I had a moment with an Aerosmith record where I put on their first record one night at this radio station. And,
Toys in the Attic?
No, the Aerosmith, the first one.
Okay.
And I put on the song, cover that they do.
Train Kept a Rolling?
Walking the Dog.
Okay.
And there's a part where Joe Perry plays sort of a percussive moment. He plays, you know, on the guitar. And I went, I want that. I want to be that. Like that was the door that opened to like, no, man, this is, and I remember looking at the back of this album cover, and there are these dudes, and they're dressed like girls, and I was like, that seems awesome. Like, these guys, nobody's, like, they were the antithesis of being an athlete. Like, they didn't have, nobody was knocking them down. They didn't have to beat people up to get women to fuck them. In fact, they get to do the opposite. They were dressed like chicks, and they were getting chicks. How the fuck, like, I just was,
yeah.
And I was always in my head, like, even the athletes I liked, even the Joe Namath, I always liked the rock star sort of, you know, that male, that not particularly stereotypical male archetype.
You like the showman, no matter what you're,
I like
no
showman,
matter what you're doing.
And I also like things that were not straight up macho.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what I've always liked about you is you're unafraid to do that. In fact, I think we were exchanging emails a couple of days ago, and I said, I'm sure you're going to wear, you know, when we do the podcast, I'm sure you're going to wear something hip and yet bordering on gay.
Yeah. Just right on the edge, or maybe just straight up gay. I mean, I might just be, I could have just put a skirt on.
I
always was like, look, the math in your head's always the same. It's like, well, I like chicks, so that's, I'm not going
to
identify.
I don't need to defend that.
I don't need to defend it, and I don't need to also broadcast it to everybody.
And even if I didn't like chicks, I don't need to defend it.
Absolutely.
Fuck you if I'm gay.
But at the time, I didn't understand. I mean, I really did like, I even though I grew up in San Francisco, you know, you just didn't want people to call you gay. That was just an insult.
It was a different time.
Because it meant more actually than gay. It meant you don't belong, bro. Yeah. And everybody wants to belong, and you're a young boy and whatever. But I always had these leanings of like, I just liked art and design and color and that kind of stuff. But I didn't know that those kind of jobs existed. I didn't understand that. And the only thing closest to it was, oh, band. I want to be in a band. That way you can dress like a chick and you can get girls and you can, you know, explore just different ideas.
And how old were you when you had your Aerosmith moment?
17.
Okay.
So late bloomer with the Aerosmith. Okay. I mean, a lot of kids, you know.
So you become a theater major, and you're starting to play music at this
point. Yeah, I have a band. I start a band at the University of Oregon. I grow my hair out. I get kicked out of the fraternity. I move into a house with like six guys.
What was the reason for getting kicked out of
drugs?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was at the University of Oregon. My mom, bless her heart, I want you to go to college out of, go away.
Yeah.
Go away. Go freak out. Take whatever you're going to do as a man and as a guy, go out of state and do it there.
Yeah.
You know, find a community of friends. You know, the University of Oregon is a beautiful campus, and it is. It's like this little home. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Everything you need is right there on campus. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can walk everywhere. Go.
Jesus, you are describing my experience at Indiana University as a theater major and a fraternity guy, except I didn't get kicked out for drugs, but every other thing. I just have to tell you that because it's. I didn't want to interrupt you.
It was just like, go. And yeah. I picked my college because that's where they filmed Animal House. And
it's like it stopped being school.
Oh, completely.
It's like there was no work. It's, I got to go to directing class? That's not work. That's fun.
No, I mean, I'm fucking making out with chicks at my theater class, and the two girls want to go in the closet, and then that's only at 3 p.m, and then we're all going to go watch a movie, and then I've got a film class, and then we're going to meet at Rennie's and drink, and then I have band practice. Like, it was kind of a heaven.
Yeah.
When I look back on it, there's a part of me that wishes I hadn't gotten so into drugs and alcohol there, because I do think, fuck, there's some classes I want to go take again.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't I pay attention you had to take sewing for your
costuming
theater degree,
yeah.
But I had someone do all my sewing for me because I just didn't want to do it. And I love clothes, and I'd love to make them. I wish I could go back and take the history of costume and that shit, because I'm fascinated with men's and women's clothes. I love clothing. Yeah. If I'd even thought about it then, I might not have even gone into theater. I might have just gone right into fashion. I would have just done that if I knew that was a job that men did, but I didn't, you know, I didn't know.
Have you ever talked about that on your podcast?
Yeah.
Because
the nickname for me on the podcast, they call Dave Man Tits and they call me Sweater Girl. Talk about it. Yeah, because I love it.
Somebody's going to contact you about that and take you to their factory or,
well,
you know,
a few people
do something.
Have, and I've started to dabble in it this last couple of years. I've started to like figure out, I mean, I've made some pants. I've done some things.
And your idea for the logo, the Clash logo, the shirts.
Right.
With the Clash logo.
With the Clash logo on it, right?
The album cover of the Clash where the guy is about to break the guitar.
Yeah, Paul Simonon smashing his bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, just right there on a polo shirt, right?
Yeah.
So you're in that insular world, and I'm starting a band, and, you know, it's like, you know, the band is only as popular as the campus. You know what I mean? You're like your popular band on campus, but you feel like fucking heroes because it's like your own little, it's literally your own planet.
Yes.
And...
And the theater department thing is wonderful, but you're also still being supported by your parents, so you don't have that need.
No, right, you know, right. No, I got a job.
It's a glorified kind of world. It's all the good, but none of the bad real stuff.
Right, exactly. And you're also like, you know, because it was University of Oregon, it was all classical theater. So we are doing Shakespeare. We are doing Sheridan. We are doing some of this really interesting shit. And people are taking ecstasy at rehearsals. And, you know, it was a great, great 6 years or whatever. I extended it. I'm really like, but I also like did like, you know, there were mushrooms that were there and ecstasy was coming up from Berkeley. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it was really, those were high times and things were cheap and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I didn't get as much, I guess I didn't get as much out of the education, but I really did like, it was a hard, tough act to follow. Mm-hmm. As soon as I graduated, I was on a downhill. It was a bummer until stand up. There was two or three years of like
fear.
Fear. What do I do?
Where am I going?
What am I doing? Yeah. Yes. I get this theater degree from the University of Oregon. It's worthless.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful adventure, but it's a worthless piece of paper. I might as well walk into this job with a rock. You know,
right.
Do you want this rock or my degree? Because the rock will at least hold your papers down. And I got nothing with this. Nothing. There's no weight to this degree at all. So
let's talk about fear for a second. Because I think that pivotal moment when you enter the real world, you're done with college, you've kind of laid the groundwork for what your dreams are and your aspirations, but then suddenly the real world is colliding with this, that now you have to support yourself.
Right. And also, what were you thinking you were really going to do?
Like, exactly.
You know, I was a good enough actor to be in plays at the University of Oregon.
Right.
And even then, I wasn't as good as the other guys. My band was a punk rock mess of clowns, all of whom graduated and went away, and it was never going to be an actual band.
Right.
And these were in the days where you couldn't just, I mean, the idea of recording something was exotic and for fancy people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know. Even the punk bands seemed like they had something, you know, like, oh, how exotic it must be to be in Black Flag, you know?
Right.
Right. But they made a record, you know, how do you make a record? You know, now you can make one at your house, but it just was one of those things where it seemed all so far away. And once it all ended, and then I was terrified because I was like, I don't know what to do.
Where do I begin?
And I don't have much of an education and I know that I like performing. And that was the weird thing. I know I like performing and I know I don't like acting. And that's a weird thing. Like, I don't love it. I never really connected with it. I had a very hard time doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do it. But I do like being in front of people.
Yeah.
I love being in front of people. And it was really fun in the band because, you know, you're up there and you dance around with your guitar and whatever. But I don't know what that becomes, you know? So I go home and I'm living with my parents for a little while, and then my buddy and I get an apartment right on the corner of Hayden Ashbury, right above on the exact corner, right above the Ben and Jerry's, right across from the Gap, in the Tourette, right above the famous sign.
And I would imagine somebody steals that sign every day.
Well, no, they had to move it further and further up. It's literally out of reach. You cannot get it because people just try and bust it off all the time. And I'm sure, you know, someone's figured out how to do it. But it was. You know, the Hate is a kind of a interesting place, but not, you know what I mean? It's sort of like living on Venice Beach.
Right.
You know, a lot of transients. A
little touristy.
Touristy. It's cold up in that part of San Francisco. It's wet a lot, you know. And I was working at Chevy's Mexican restaurant. I was waiting tables and drinking. And this is when it really starts to, my alcoholism really starts to escalate because it's not going well for me. I'm sad and I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing.
And what do you,
I'm going on auditions.
Feelings that you remember, having when you were in that time?
Well, I was angry because I didn't like my roommates.
Mm-hmm.
I was fearful of like not knowing what I was going to do. And also like there was a part of me like, did I just waste 6 years?
Right.
Like, what the fuck do I do? I have an agent because my dad knew a guy and he sends me out on commercial auditions and they're horrible.
The worst.
And I'm horrible.
Yeah.
And then I'm going up for terrible plays that are being held in someone's basement. I mean, it just is really sad. And my mom is encouraging me to read whatever that thing is that actors read, you know, those
the call sheet or whatever.
The call sheet or whatever those things are called. She says, there's an audition for an improv group. I'm like, Mom, just fucking back off. Mm-hmm. And she's like, just please, just go. Just try. You were good. You taught improv in college. Just try it. So I go to this improv group thing, and I enjoy it. And I get in the group. And 2 weeks later, Margaret Cho joins the group.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... We're terrible, but it's fun. And we also, this particular group also performs at the Renaissance Fair and does a play every year. And Margaret says, you got to try stand up. And I was like, do you think? She's like, and there's another kid in the group named John Bauman. And they're like, you got to try stand up. And I'm like, are you kicking me out of the improv group? I don't understand. They're like, no, you would probably be good at stand up. You should think about it. And I'd never thought of it. So I never came to stand up with a great need to do it. It almost became like, well, here's what's left for you, kid.
Right.
You have a sense of humor and you like standing in front of people and you're a little bit of a sociopath. So why don't you do that? You know, I was trying to put a band together. That wasn't happening at that time. And so I took a shot. I made some friends in this improv group, made a good friend named Laura Milligan. And we went out on a Tuesday night. I think it was Monday or Tuesday night. It was February 28th of 89. And I was 35th on a list. It started at like 7 o'clock and went to midnight. Ooh. And 34, a guy named Mel went up and just stared at everybody and panicked and ran off the stage. And then it was me. And I went up and for 3 minutes, I said some horse shit, some goofy and surreal, bizarre shit. And people laughed and I tagged myself out. I'm like, well, that's enough for me. Good night, everybody. Yeah. I think you were allowed 5 minutes and I did three.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing that ever happened. You know, I was like, oh, okay. All right. This is what I do. This is my thing. I did it and it worked the first time. I've never, my whole life, it's been a series of, I'm just going to have to work harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything, sports, even with girls, like I just couldn't get it to work. And stand up just boom, open that door
mm-hmm.
to the point where you're like, oh, I don't have, this is something I can actually do that
right.
I can put a minimal amount of effort in. I mean, I can put a lot mm-hmm. too, but I can put a minimal amount.
So the lesson that I get out of that is always listen to alcoholics.
Well, always listen to your mom. Here's the weird thing. I'm realizing this as a parent. It's like you see people and you know them and you know what they're, it's hard. And, you know, as an alcoholic, like you can't have no control over people, places and things. Mm-hmm. But if you keep whispering something into somebody's ear, maybe it'll, mm-hmm. maybe someday it'll, I mean, every good decision I've ever made was one my mom would have agreed upon. I mean, I didn't, wasn't until I met Amira that my mom went, yeah, okay.
Yeah. There's something that's so great about the energy that moms have towards their kids. My relationship with my mom, she was always encouraged. She wanted me to be a dancer, which, you know, she, oh, you have such a good sense of rhythm. You should be a dancer.
Right.
And I always try to say, no, I'm really not interested in doing that.
Right.
But she's always supported my comedy. And she would, I was so afraid after I got out of college, just like you, was auditioning for theater companies that I had no respect for plays I wasn't even interested in. But I was afraid to get up on stage by myself. My mom kept saying, I read somewhere.
And where is this?
Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mom kept, and I auditioned for an improv group and got in. It was Dino Stamatopoulos who went on to do Mr. Show, Andy Dick.
Yeah.
Actually, we were trying to get Andy in the improv group, and the guy who had started the group didn't think Andy was funny. And we kept saying, hey, he's a funny guy. You should let him in.
Oh, my God.
And then Andy and Dino went off and started doing their thing. But this whole time I wanted to do stand up, but I was so afraid to get up on stage by myself. And my mom kept saying, I read somewhere that if you keep your ideas down, just jot them down on 3x5 cards. And then when you get enough 3x5 cards, you can just go up and do it. And she would just kept saying, just try it. Just try it. And I would just go into the basement after my, you know, day job at the insurance company, and I would drink and I would get high and I would fantasize about the someday that I'm going to get up. And then for some reason, one day I just tried it.
Just did it.
And she was right.
Yeah.
You know, God bless you, moms.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. My mom and I had a very, like, my mom was not a good, did not deliver the message well. She would always be
with,
like,
her heavy feet and her thick tongue.
Well, it would just be like, well, I don't understand why you don't do stand up. You know, well, that's not the way you want to tell someone to do something.
Right.
But I think I wanted a spiritual solution. I feel like I was looking for hope. I feel like all of that was just, how do I feel happy? Where I'm looking for God. I'm looking for God in a handful of ecstasy. I'm trying to find that moment, because that's all that is chasing that perfect high, that feeling of like
the feeling
you
that
belong,
you just go,
and yes, I'm okay, yes. And I'm a, and I, but and I have purpose. And I think since I got sober, I found that, like, so that was really it, because I didn't, I mean, that would have been nice if my mom had been an alcoholic, and there's some things, maybe I have some resentments or whatever, but I never felt like, I never real, like, my story is not one where I go, I always felt weird. I'm like, I always thought everyone's weird. I don't believe in normal people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in them. I think hipsters are almost the most normal people in the world, because they're the most extreme conformists, to the point where their conformity sets them apart and makes them such unbelievable assholes that I, you know,
right.
That when they're like, well, I'm not like normal people. Well, fuck, I don't know a normal person. I right. really don't. Everybody yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way. They have some little weird thing. That's what makes us so fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, the emails that I've been getting from people that have found this podcast have been so encouraging, because there's so many people out there that are blown away that we feel just the way that they do. They think that they're alone in having insecurities. You know, I have this survey on the website that you can take. And I ask, there's about 20 questions you can ask. And, you know, one of the questions are, what are the common negative thoughts you have towards yourself? And you can go and you can see other people's responses.
Mm-hmm.
And about 400 people have taken the survey so far. And there is such a common theme running through there of the negative ways people look at themselves,
right.
The fears that we have, the things that we feel shame over, the things that we feel guilty over.
Right.
And I've never felt so connected to other people since I started doing this podcast. I felt connected to people once I got sober and stopped anesthetizing my feelings.
Yeah.
But I've been really blown away at how much thirst people have to feel a part of, and how pervasive that feeling that we're broken, we're not enough, and we're alone.
Right.
Is.
Right. It's, I think it's standard operating procedure for being a human being. And because we have, I look at religions, and I probably will offend some people here, but I look at religions almost like your phone carrier. Everybody has a different service mm-hmm. to get to the same thing. This basic,
that's what I say. It's different rooms into different doors into the same room.
And I'm happy for people to go whatever way they want and think whatever they want. But I do believe the one commonality is that a lot of us want to believe that there's a purpose to all of this, and it yeah. just seems like there is. My feeling is that, like, you know, God isn't a sentient being that's going to, like, solve things. We got the whole thing. We were given the whole thing. And mm-hmm. I think it's like, okay, now
how
go
do you
play.
Tap into that? How do you let it out?
Well, it's, you know, I think part of it is, like, make good decisions and stop hurting each other. I gave you a fucking planet. I gave you animal. I gave you a brain. I figured out, you guys, this is a fucking, it's a gigantic game that I gave you mm-hmm. that should end up perfect if you just do it right.
Mm-hmm.
If you just treat people with love, if you just allow people to have their things, if you just, you know, police each other in a way that any decent human being would be, and if you just make good decisions, and if you're of service, if you spend most of your life thinking about others, everything will go fine. As soon as you start thinking about yourself, that's when things go awry.
Yeah.
It's just not as complicated as we've made it. That's how I need to process it.
Right.
That's my, again, this is all just me. And when I had that very simple understanding of things, my life immediately just got better. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, so this is really it, you know?
Yeah.
I have my crosses to bear like everybody else, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to carry these resentments. I'm going to lay that. I love that blues phrase. I'm going to lay my burden down.
Mm-hmm.
Lay it down.
What are some common fears? I want to try something. I've never done this before, but let's go back and forth, with fears that we have.
Yeah.
And, try it until we run out.
Right.
And I'll start it off with a bad one. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
I'm afraid that mine is too small.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that my wife isn't as attracted to me as she used to be.
I am afraid that I won't work again.
I am afraid that I am going to regret how I live my life when I'm in my 60s.
I'm afraid that the band won't play enough shows this year.
I am afraid that I am going to misjudge how this podcast is going to be received and put too much energy into it and be disappointed.
I'm almost afraid to say the thing that I'm most afraid of is that something awful will happen to one or both of my children.
I am afraid that we're due for an earthquake and I'm going to see my pets or my wife suffer.
I am afraid that I've taken my family down a really bad path and I don't know how to get back.
I am afraid that I'm going to get cancer.
I am afraid that I'm not going to get all of the things done that I want to get done before I leave.
I am afraid that I've run out of things to say I'm afraid.
I'm right there with you.
All right. I think that was enough then.
Yeah.
That was good. That felt good.
Yeah. I mean, those are like real. I mean, I went through a really anxious period a little while ago. I went through a bad patch, and coming off of the, he's just not that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I co-wrote this book for, we wrote it for fun. It became a much bigger deal than anybody ever expected it to, least of all me. It took my life in a direction that I wasn't sure how to go to. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly went from being a stand-up to being a self-help, to use the somebody else's terminology, guru,
mm-hmm.
or expert. And while I feel comfortable answering questions, I didn't feel comfortable with the title of guru or like that.
Right.
And I never wanted that. I never wanted it, right. ever. I never, even in writing the book, assumed that it would happen. So I didn't, it wasn't something.
And I think anybody that calls themselves a self-help guru can't be that good.
No.
It's like I saw a license plate that said idea man. How good are your ideas if that's one of them?
Right. That's a terror. Right. And things happen in your life and you're like, well, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do now. You suppose my instincts are saying, well, maybe, but all these opportunities are coming and mm-hmm. they're some of them are financial and some of them are professional and
right.
But I'm now on a different path than I was on before. I was really on a
stand-up. This is a couple of years ago.
Yeah, this is 5 years ago, 2005. Mm. This is when the book hit. And I went to this weird place and I was, you know, I became enormously popular for a brief moment. Like it's almost like an afternoon.
Yeah, you told me about being at a hotel and who's the rap guy that asked to have your autograph or a picture taken with
Nas.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even know he was.
Yeah.
My mom loves your show, man. I love your show. And I'm like, oh, what do you do? I'm a musician. What's your name? Nas. You got to be shitting me. What is happening? but I just proud of, you know, it's interesting. It's like you do something and you're proud of it and you love it, but it's not all of who you are, but you can't explain that to people as it's happening. And that's all people want from you. And look, it's a classic story.
You probably don't know what else to do at that point.
You don't. And the opportunities are coming and you know, your wife's pregnant and she's, you know, suddenly some of these things happen. But the trade-off you make is when it's over and it ends and it will end, then where are you?
Mm-hmm.
And I was miles away from the comedy shore that I'd been at. Not that I was like ever a very popular comic beforehand, but I had put a lot of time into that
mm-hmm.
and establishing that. And I wiped it out because the people that liked me just got bored and went somewhere else, or the people that, or they decided they didn't like me, or I became more famous for that. People forgot that I did comedy, and a lot of people didn't know that I did comedy. So when I'd go out and do shows, people would come out, I'd sell tickets, but they weren't there to see stand-up necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And while they would, you know, the shows were fine, I'd come back the next time they weren't there because
mm-hmm.
they had wanted some other experience I yeah. wasn't able to give them. And suddenly I watched my career really start to I dropped from this very high place that I was for. I would say I had an afternoon of fame, mm-hmm. I had a nice afternoon of fame. And I got very, very scared. And the thing that I did wrong was I fought it. And as soon as you're on somebody else's problem, as soon as that phone rings and it's a guy that I can talk to and say, oh shit. Yeah. I know what you're doing. And I'm not, the thing that's different about like with the self-help book is like, I'm not telling a guy what to do. I'm never telling someone what to do. I'm just saying, here's what I did.
Yeah.
here's how I screwed up. This is what I thought helped solve my problem.
And sometimes halfway through the phone call, you realize you're more fucked up than that person, and they're helping you. That's the thing that is so amazing about helping other people.
Yeah.
Just putting yourself out there by saying, hey, here's my phone number. Call me if you want to need to talk.
But it's because the thing about it is, it's not I know more. It's just one person talking to another, just sharing the fucking human experience and saying, look, here's what I do. And people love to be able to answer your questions. That helps him, because now we're not talking about him anymore.
And he feels a sense of purpose. He gets to get out of himself.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I can't believe you're asking me a question. Right. Well, blah, blah, blah. And then he's thrilled and he had an answer.
Right.
And I liked his answer. And I was like, that's going to do it. That's going to solve my problem. Thank you. That's exactly what I'll do. I'll take your advice. You know, sometimes, you know, and that's all we're really meant to do, you know, on a bigger level. It doesn't have to be in the context of a program. It can just be with your wife or with your kids or with
group therapy,
your roommate,
just going to a coffee place and hanging out.
Spend one day just saying to people, the first thing you say to them is, how can I help you today? Or what can I do for you today? Mm-hmm. Is there anything you need? You know, I mean, it feels powerful to actually say that to people, because they're like, oh, that's so funny you asked me. I really, you know, I don't mind. Occasionally I end up finding myself driving a guy to the airport. All right. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but enough of that stuff starts happening and I forget that, oh, right. I have a career that I'm not happy. You know what I mean? And then suddenly something happens.
Isn't that, let's talk about that for a second. It almost seems like helping other people is little breadcrumbs on a trail to this beautiful life that has always been there, but it just becomes revealed.
Yeah.
When we take time out to consider other people and their feelings.
Yep.
And by that, you know, without being a doormat, without, you know, being enabling or you know, codependent, but taking time out to care about the world, things happen on their own. There's synchronicity that is mind-blowing.
Well, that for me is the spiritual connection. That's like, well, now I'm locked in.
Yeah.
Now I'm on my plan. Now I'm on my thing. When I do that, I get handed the things I need. You know, they come in different shapes than I thought. They come in different ways than I thought. They come at different times than I expected them to come.
Yeah.
Some things come back up. Some things go away. Something random comes away. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I remember years ago I'd lost a job and I was out working with a guy and I literally had nothing going on in my career. Nothing. And I just lost a big job and I'm with this guy and we're just, you know, we're talking about life or whatever. And I get a phone call from my wife and they're like, Variety decided you're going to be one of their 10. I'm like, well, they did. Why? I said, I don't know. They just decided today you're going to be one of their 10 comics that they're profiling, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it would have been months, like nothing. Like it just took care of itself. Because I'd done work, you can't have an imaginary career, you have to go do open mics and do stand up and do that stuff. You have to do the little work. You have to do the work. You know, part
but
of the
then
work
step
is helping
back and stay out of obsessing about where it's going to lead
can't,
and what the
you,
results
you,
are going to be.
You can't do anything about the results. That's the problem. You just can't do anything about the results.
That to me is one of the biggest tools to having a chance at sanity, is getting a clear picture on what I have control over and what I don't have control over. And for so much of my life, I tried to control things that I had no control over. I got to share something interesting happened to me. Somebody had suggested that I try meditating because I was just caught in one of these negative thought kind of loops that I could see was just degrading the quality of my life. And this person said, well, you should consider meditation. So I took this meditation class, and the woman that taught me how to meditate, she said, you know, one of the things that people who meditate discover is the world becomes more fluid and there's less friction. Things come to them easier. And I remember thinking, I don't understand how meditating is really going to do that. I had to go back home to do a hockey fundraiser later that week. And there's three pieces of equipment that I needed to get. I needed to get a new helmet, a new pair of hockey pants, and a pair of hockey gloves. And the night before I was going to go buy those three items, a friend of mine said, hey, this guy I know bought this equipment and was going to play hockey, but never took it up. This is a couple days after I started meditating. He goes, he gave it to me, and you're the only person I know that plays hockey. Would you like it? It's a pair of hockey gloves, a pair of pants, and a helmet.
Yeah.
And they all fit perfectly. And I just, it's like there are times when the universe just throws you these bones that keep you going, and you just
totally.
Kind of,
I no, I mean, and the thing that's so funny. So you tell a story like that, and certainly there are people listening, and in their head, the word, you know, coincidence is coming in, and it's like, absolutely. We won't call it a coincidence,
but you get enough of them.
But also, like, but what do you get out of blocking the idea that it might actually be some divine intervention? Like, what's your big mistake in going, well, maybe there is somebody paying attention to me up there. Maybe the universe, however that works, is paying attention to me on some level.
Yeah.
It's not solving my problems.
Right.
But it just, like, I let go of a need because I couldn't do anything about it. And it just sort of showed up. I had a very similar experience when I first got sober, but like I had no money. I called my parents. I told them I didn't want anything from them anymore, that I had taken too much from them, that I had used them. And I was sorry, and I was going to make it my own way. And all I wanted was a fucking candle. I wanted a candle in my bedroom. I wanted some sort of thing. And I didn't have any money and blah, blah, blah. And I went to a friend's house, and she goes, you know what? I got this box of candles today. And I, you know, I was like, okay. Yeah, I really want. And then it meant so much more. It was from a friend, and it came. And yeah. I wanted it for the same reason, just so I could light a candle and meditate or do whatever. Yeah. And there are those times where I do feel like it's just nudging you, like, it's almost like a light going, now you're on the right path. It's not, I'm solving your problems. It's like, this is where you're supposed to be for this stuff to happen. This is the, keep doing the thing that you're doing. You're going back to do this thing. You know, you're going back to an event for somebody. You're, you know, and it doesn't cost me anything to have faith.
Right.
That something good could happen.
Yeah.
You know, to be slightly optimistic. I mean, that's how I knew that I was in trouble when I first stopped drinking, because I was like, oh, I hate everybody. and I'm blaming everybody for my lot in life, and it's clearly my fault. And I'm actually not I'm chemically not predisposed that way. I'm a fairly upbeat, fairly positive guy.
Yeah.
And I was a lot of my life, even throughout my mom's alcoholism and the weird things that we went through. So
you've never had bouts of sustained bouts of depression or
only right after I went through a pretty black time right after the He's Just Not That Into You came out, and then. I had a talk show, and the talk show was canceled, and then
that led to the black part, because
I lost everything. I lost my agent became the head of eight. I lost my agent, my manager, my lawyer. I lost everything. I literally lost everything. Our book company dropped us. Like, I lost everything. I couldn't get anyone. It was a classic show business thing where you go, oh, this actually happens. People dump you. They're done with you, and they dump you.
Right.
And I didn't know what I did know. I wouldn't accept.
Right.
The only thing that's going to fix this is time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing. You had your dance. Everybody saw you. They fucked you. They're done.
Right.
Go home. Put on a new outfit. Wait a while. Come back.
Right.
And that is show business. The tide comes in and the tide goes out. And I feel like I refuse to. I was like, no. I'm the exception to the rule. I will fucking. And I tried. I fought it. I fought my reality, and I got very depressed.
And can you describe how you fought that reality? What were you doing that?
Yelling at my manager, trying to figure out why I couldn't get certain things to have happen, and being upset with the audiences that came out that didn't understand that I was also a comedian. Like just finding fights. I was finding fights. I was finding fights with people. I wasn't accepting the reality of my life, that this thing was going to be bigger than me for a while, and that I was going to have to find new ways to do it. I mean, you know. The one nice thing was about it is I work at things all the time. So I was like, oh, I think I'll play some music.
Mm-hmm.
No one's expecting it. No one needs it.
Yeah.
There won't be, I can't disappoint anybody. I want to write instrumental surf style music, because then it can be interpreted by anyone anyway. I don't want to be in a band with a singer. And so I did that, and I found a project I could throw myself into that I loved and was pure and was artistic and had there was no goal with it.
Yeah.
There wasn't like, this is my thing. This was like, this is something that's simply so that when I get into my car, I can listen to it.
That's where I listened to it. You gave me a CD and I loved it.
That's
great. It's called the Reigning Monarchs is the name of the CD. And the title of the CD itself is
The Reigning Monarchs.
Yeah.
Self-titled debut. Yeah. You can get it to thereigningmonarchs.com. You can download it for free or a price of your choosing.
Yes. And reigning is spelled reigning.
And that was the beginning of like realizing, like, you know, for a while, you're going to have to make things on your own. Everyone's, you know, it's not,
but you're not going to die. You're not going to disappear.
Well, that was, my wife was like, I don't understand. We, you know, there's a roof and the kids are in school. And
how do they not freak? Why are we wired to be the ones that freak out? Or is it just that one spouse freaks out and the other one automatically?
Well, I think probably you assume whatever role that you're in. You know, my wife has never been a freaker outer. My wife is just a solid, solid human being. And I think I don't feel... as a man, I don't feel complete unless I'm working.
Yeah.
I just don't. I can't attribute that to anything other than for Greg Barrett. Greg Barrett needs to be working to feel complete. I'd love, you know, you can't put that. And people are like, well, what about your kids and your family? I'm like, well, that's a lot of pressure to put on them to bring me my happiness. My job is to make them happy. Mm-hmm. My job is to make sure that True and Mighty are sorted and that they're getting connection from me and that we're doing things together. And I certainly get some joy out of that, but that is not my vocation, nor is it it can't be my passion. My passion can't be my children. They don't want that. What do I do when that's done and they leave? That's the wrong way to parent. I think that, you know, my job is to make sure that they are feeling good and encouraging them and being there with them. But I don't want them to feel the pressure of, oh God, Dad wants our attention now.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Dad needs to feel happy. So we're going to do what, you know what I mean?
Like, I think there's a lot in this generation of parents that are smothering their kids because they're trying to compensate for the lack of attention they got from their parents.
Yeah. I mean, what my kids know is that they're loved, they are well taken care of, that they can ask us anything, that they are, that this is, this is a safe environment for them to be around too. You know, I'm sober, my wife's a normie. But they also get to have their own lives and they get to be their own people and they don't have to, you know, but I can't derive, just like I can't derive pleasure from my wife. She's not my thing. She's my wife. I'm in love with her, but I can't make her my happiness or my kids. They will just be, they'd
You'd be disappointed because nobody can fulfill
and
that.
I'm happy in creation.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what the plan is for me. Like, I, every time I went to that area, like, I'm happy. When I make my podcast, I don't care that it, for me, the money thing is more about making sure my family's taken care of because I can do without money. But as far as creating goes, I just, you know, I go up and I do my podcast with my buddy and we put it on our website and people listen to it and we make our little videos and we have a blast and we're not making a dime, but we love it. And it's pure me, you know? Yeah. And so then I feel healthy. So that also came out of it. So those are things I did to get better. Yeah. I started to create my own fires. Instead of asking for Hollywood if I could be in show business, I just started making my own show business.
Dude, I'm so glad I came over today and got to... that was fun doing the fear thing. I enjoy that. I always feel so good when I get my fears out in the open.
Yeah.
You know, without doing it inappropriately and just, you know, dumping on a stranger. You know, hey, you're going to have a latte? You know, I'm afraid that...
Well, sometimes too, like I notice when you do me, you're acknowledging me, like, well, that's not really that big, but you know what I mean? Like if you give voice to them, they sort of then dissipate a little bit. They feel a little bit less like, you know, as you're thinking of them and they're coming out of your mouth and you're like, I'm afraid of that, but I could, you know, I mean, I can handle it. You know what I mean? Like when you have a family and you decide you're going to have kids, that's the gamble you take that something's going to happen to them. They're people. Things happen to me as a kid. That just is the way it is. But you don't, you know, you don't want them to. And so you hold that thought, but you know, there just isn't, we were built to navigate these waters.
Yeah.
You know, that's how we were built. You know, there really is nothing you can't handle, you know, and when you can't, the beautiful thing about life is, and this has been in all of our books and all of our self-help books and the He's Just Not That Into You. And then it's called A Breakup Because It's Broken. We're always saying, look, there's always someone you can talk to. There's always someone.
Yeah.
Clergy. There are so many people have dedicated their lives to it. You know, our book is simply a jumping off point. Do you know that you're good enough to not be in a shit relationship? Because if you don't know it, I will tell you. And we say it in that tone. Fucking get it together. You're a superstar. This is horseshit. Stop accepting less than good behavior and get to it. And then if you're having trouble with it, see a professional.
Yeah.
Go talk to somebody. People love to hear you talk. People want to help you. I know that like I told you before, I love it when my phone rings. Because now it's not. Now the voices in my head have to be quiet because we're listening to somebody.
And I think that's the perfect note to end on. So if you're out there and you're struggling and you're feeling stuck, get some help. Talk to somebody. Don't try to solve it yourself. And know that there is hope and you are not alone. So thanks for listening.